Good morning. Yesterday I read the first section of the Poshan piece on admonishments for those unable to arouse the doubt. The section I titled Diseases, Intellectual and Anti-Intellectual. Now I will introduce the second section, which could be called the disease of quiet meditation. Quote, if you are unable to arouse the doubt when practicing Zen, you may end up developing an aversion for the external world, an aversion, a hatred for the external world. Thus, you escape to a quiet place and sink into Zazen meditation, thinking you attain some power from this. You find it quite fascinating. When you have to get up and do something, however, you dislike it. This, too, is simply your wavering mind. It is not Zen. Sitting long in Zazen, sunk in quietness, within this mystic darkness, the senses fuse, objects and opposition disappear. But even if you enter dhyana absorption without mind movement, it's no different from the Hinayana. Any contact with the world and you lose your supposed freedom. Hearing sounds or seeing sights, you are gripped by fear and your meditation is disturbed. Frightened, you become as if demon-possessed and commit evil acts. In the end, you waste a lifetime of practice in vain. All because, from the first, your faulty beginner's mind failed to arouse this doubt. Thus, you did not seek out a true guide or trust them. Instead, you stubbornly sit self-satisfied in your quiet hole. Even if you meet a good teacher or Dharma friend, if you don't immediately recognize your error, innumerable Buddhas may appear and preach the Dharma, but they won't be able to save you. This is Poshan's second admonishment about quiet meditation, or we might say attachment to getting stuck in quiet meditation. As with the first section, there's not so much difficult to understand, but let me read it through one more time, adding brief comments when necessary. If there's something you don't understand, feel free to speak up. Once again, if you're unable to arouse the doubt when practicing Zen, you may end up developing an aversion for the external world. Thus, you escape to a quiet place and sink into Zazen meditation, thinking you attain some power from this. You find it quite fascinating. When you have to get up and do something, however, you dislike it. This, too, is simply your wavering mind. It is not Zen. This first paragraph, in a sense, has to be taken up, has to be said. Within the Zen tradition, sitting in Zazen meditation is very important. It's very central to the practice, whether in Soto or in Rinzai. In a sense, the practice centers on seated Zen, Zazen. So it's not so difficult to see how it can go off in the wrong direction. One can become sunk, become attached to that. It's a danger that comes with the territory. And so already in this second section, he is pointing it out. It has been pointed out by many others. Continuing the quote, "Sitting long in Zazen, sunk in quietness, within this mystic darkness, the senses fuse, objects and opposition disappear." Not such a bad state. He's talking about a deep and concentrated samadhi. What's so wrong with that, you might wonder? Well, let us see where it goes, huh? Continuing, "But even if you enter dhyana absorption," literally a zenjo, of course, dhyana is the word that became channa, and eventually zen, son in Korea, and zen in Japan. But here it refers more to a profound kind of meditative state known as dhyana, dhyana absorption. And he explains, "But even if you enter dhyana absorption without mind movement," there's no movement of mind at all. It's a very deep state, for sure. He continues, though, "But even if you enter dhyana absorption without mind movement, it's no different from the Hinayana," literally the small vehicle, in the language of the times, the small vehicle of self-enlightenment, the arhat simply winning enlightenment for himself. As you probably know, this is a general criticism by Mahayana. They call themselves the great vehicle, criticizing the limits of the more traditional form known as Hinayana, or the small vehicle. This is a kind of, a politically inappropriate statement. Rather than saying he's criticizing the Hinayana, Zen masters sometimes speak of this simply meaning an attachment to one's own attainment, whether one is a Zen monk or a Theravada monk or whatever. But he does actually use the term small vehicle. Well, in our 21st century political correctness, let us excise that from the text, huh? Or if we do include it, remember that he's talking about a state that one may get stuck in and not a particular school of Buddhism. He goes on to describe quite clearly this state and its danger. "Any contact with the world and you lose your supposed freedom. Hearing sounds or seeing sights, you're gripped by fear and your meditation is disturbed. Frightened, you become as if demon-possessed and commit evil acts. In the end, you waste a lifetime of practice in vain." It's powerful stuff. He's really bringing the hammer down, bringing the sword down. We could probably do some research and get some idea of who the monks were or the people around him that caused him to say these things. But once again, that's something for the scholars. For us, here and now, in a retreat, we are the subject of his criticism. And if any of it applies in the least bit, we accept it with deep appreciation. If not, well, we put it on the back burner. It may come in handy later on. It's clear, I think, huh? In entering into this very deep state, one becomes attached to it, and then one does not want to have it disturbed by the troublesome outside world, other people, other circumstances. So we just sit wrapped up in our little samadhi or dhyana. The problem is obvious, I think. Huh? We think we have achieved some kind of oneness, but obviously it's not oneness, is it? It's a oneness that's separate from the external world. It's already two, isn't it? It's a forced, fake oneness that can't help but fall in upon itself. And so he rightly points this out, criticizes it. Continuing, all because from the first your faulty beginner's mind failed to arouse this doubt. He's cutting to the quick. Thus you did not seek out a true guide or trust them. Instead, you stubbornly sit self-satisfied in your quiet hole. No comment is needed here, I think. Even if you meet a good teacher or Dharma friend, if you don't immediately recognize your error, innumerable Buddhas may appear and preach the Dharma, but they won't be able to save you. This is the end of the second section, and as he often does in many of the sections, he ends with a kind of almost a threat to the person, of course, out of compassion, to try and shake them out of their delusion, out of their sickness, their illness. In a word, this second section is pointing out the dis-ease or the sickness of quiet meditation itself, or perhaps more precisely, attachment to quiet meditation, quiet states that we may attain. Once again, the states need not be criticized themselves. These are profound states of samadhi and dhyana that Gautama Buddha himself clearly describes their value and their limit in the Pali Suttas, for example. But as Poshan likes to say it, Zen Yarazu. It is not Zen. Because this section is on quiet meditation, I want to repeat that genuine shikantaza, or just sitting, pure and uncontrived, just sitting of the Soto school of Zen Buddhism, is fine. It is complete in itself. It will do if taken all the way. Needless to say, the same applies to koan Zen. If the koan becomes a plaything that we work and we get insights out of, we are not going all the way with the koan. We are passing koans like passing gas. The essential point of section 2, to put it bluntly, don't get stuck in stillness. Recognize it. Be able to work through it. Yes, naturally we enter deep states of samadhi and dhyana as we pursue and learn to practice properly. But don't get stuck there. When I use as the title of the main lecture, getting stuck, I mean getting stuck right here, not in a mere state of meditation. The entire self-complex getting stuck is what Zen means by getting stuck and breaking through. Each one of these states of samadhi and dhyana have their own value, their own virtue, and their own limit. But they are not the end or the goal. Become attached to it, become entangled in it, and it becomes itself a kind of disease, so to speak. On the one hand, you can see clearly, I think, how becoming trapped in your little quiet hole is a danger, and it's a false oneness. It tries to negate or avoid the external world. Well, it's not one, is it? And yet, it is a very tempting escape, isn't it? Because at least within that little hole, we've managed to cut out all of the 10,000, 10 million troubles and vexations of the world, haven't we? Huh? Oh, believe me, it can be very tempting, huh? All the troubles and all the vexations of the external world, and in a sense of the internal world as well, if it's a deep state of meditation, it's all gone. And then we want to cling on to that. Beware. In traditional Zen terms, great faith or great trust, great determination, great tenacity, and the third, great doubt, are considered the three essentials for Zen practice. In typical Chinese manner, they talk about it as like a pot which has three legs. Well, if any one of those legs is broken, the whole thing just falls over. It's quite useless. But if all three legs stand, it's a fine kettle. We can put all kinds of rat turds in there. Once again, great faith or great trust is listed as the first one. I think for obvious reasons, I don't think any one of you would be here now doing what you're doing if you did not have some degree of great trust, great faith. So I won't belabor that point. The second one, great tenacity, or great determination of purpose, it's sometimes translated. In American English, I would translate it as stick-to-itiveness. You know that. I think it's a typical Americanism. Perhaps I should say North Americanism. I don't know if you use it in Canada or not, but stick-to-itiveness. Well, I'm pretty sure they don't use it in Britain. They must have a much more sophisticated word to say it. Because we don't in America, we come up with these. Stick-to-itiveness, huh? You don't let go, huh? So again, great tenacity or stick-to-itiveness. Or again, more descriptive, great determination of purpose. We don't waver, or even when we do, we immediately come back, huh? The way may not always be clear, but we do not give up. We do not give in. We continue. Of course, especially in the beginning, as I described yesterday, there is an element of willpower here, and it can get in the way. That's why all three legs are essential. Great faith or great trust. The second one now, great tenacity, great determination of purpose. Stick-to-itiveness. And once again, I'm not going to belabor that second point because you're already here. We're already into the third day. You've already manifest that to some extent. The third is great doubt. Note that in Zen, both great faith and its apparent opposite, great doubt, fit together to support this. You might say in the middle is that great determination of purpose. Huh? It's not a contradiction at all. It's not a contradiction at all. I trust that this third part, great doubt, is becoming clear. And with that, your practice can continue on seamlessly, supported by great trust, great faith. Again, partly through your own experience, as you come to know it, you can't help but have trust and continue on. And then that determination to take it to the end, once and for all. And again, in a sense, that is powered by your own genuine doubt. What you do not know, where you cannot come to rest, that is what powers us in a sense. I trust in this retreat you are becoming intimate with that third of the three legs. The great, I emphasize, great doubt. Are there any questions or concerns about this second section on the disease of quiet meditation? Yes.
The Buddha speaks of the dis-ease. How would he speak of the ease? So I think.
To ask the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, I think one of the clearest expressions was when very early on in his ministry he met with a wealthy boy, young man, who basically said just that. I tell the story in one of my earlier lectures where he is a very wealthy young man, and he's being entertained and has everything he needs, everything he could even want. But he happens to wake up in the middle of the night and see all of this in disarray, and the young ladies with their legs sprawled out in a most unattractive manner, and he's shocked and, as it says, disgusted by it all. And he turns away from the world. He realizes the great dis-ease, huh, of it all. Huh? And he leaves and encounters Gautama Buddha. Without any kind of introduction or explanation, he apparently walks up to Gautama Buddha, who is sitting in meditation, and says, "This, or it is all dis-ease, it is all distress." And Gautama's response is, "What?
There is no dis-ease here.
This is not, yes. Here is no distress." He doesn't say, "I got four noble truths here now. You got a pen? All right. We're going to start with that stuff, all right? And then we're going to go, there's an end. And not only is there an end, there's a way. Eight. Remember, eight, okay? Write them down." No. That's rather Zenistic, perhaps. But once again, the person comes. He doesn't give an explanation because he's in the middle of it. So he says, again, as I put it in American English, "It all sucks." And so Gautama Buddha simply, how does he respond? Well, in that situation, he responded, "This doesn't suck." This is not distress.
There's a double negative there. Yeah. No disease. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in a description of the ease without getting into... Now, how do you talk about the no disease? Do you say, "I feel one with all things and all people. I have no more worries.
Neither of those is a description of it, no. But why is it so important here in the middle of a retreat to be concerned with descriptions of it? I would hope after the retreat you would try your best to give accurate expression to it. There is a place for that, you know. Zen, with all this not relying on words and letters, is the Japanese Buddhist school that has the largest collection of writings. You look at the Tripitaka, you know. They have more writings than any other school in Japanese Buddhism. And a lot of that writing is saying, "Don't rely on us." And a lot of people say, "Now, see that? I'm not going to rely on it because it says it right here." It's very easy to trip over our own feet.
So let the intellect alone.
Yes. Well, yeah, I wouldn't worry about how to describe it. Why don't you just dive in and fully know it for yourself? That's what a retreat is for. This isn't a seminar, you know, on Zen expressions. You can be as sloppy as you want here, but no, at the same time, when you really look carefully, Zen can be very finicky about expression. A lot of what is called the koan practice in Zen is precisely making sure that you can accurately express where you are. Both to give expression to it, and perhaps to aid others in various ways. So in a way, your question is an important one. Zen does not deny that. A lot of the koan practice is actually concerned with that issue. How to accurate, if you don't accurately express your state, even though you may be very deeply realized, it will be denied. No, won't do. So your question is not entirely out of place, but here in the retreat, I would urge you, just dive in. The words can come later. You're a rather eloquent person. I wouldn't worry about it. Okay? It's if I may put it bluntly, in a retreat, that's a secondary issue. Okay?
It's an easier one, though. That's why I go for it.
Is it, huh?
It's an easier one, however.
Perhaps.
Yeah, more prone to that. Hmm.
Yeah, there's a statement that says something like, realizing nirvana is not so difficult, but carrying it out in the world, that's the humdinger, if I give it a modern word. So they're both quite a challenge. But first things first. Any other questions or concerns? Let us take a break. It's been about a half an hour. Please feel free to stand up and stretch.